Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, September 11th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent and Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, check in with Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford, and Cindy McCormick at the Cape Cod Times. We'll hear from Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, CAI's Mike Dean up at the State House, and we'll hear from CAI's Eve Zuckoff. We learned more this week about the cluster of COVID-19 cases in employees at the Chatham Squire restaurant. 7 workers at the restaurant have tested positive. And that follows an earlier Chatham outbreak in July when at least 13 cases were tied to a house party. CAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us to talk about the latest information. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve. Good to be here.
So, Jeanette, what do we know about the origin of these cases?
Well, first, we know the number hasn't changed. It's holding steady at 7 cases in this outbreak. And what the town's top health official said yesterday is that some of those employees from the Chatham Squire may have attended the same work-related gathering together, not at the work location, but a work-related gathering. This is from Robert Duncanson from the town of Chatham. He was quick to say it was not a social party. He also said, really, they don't have proof that that is where the cluster of cases originated.
So we're talking about a restaurant here, obviously, that raises concerns for public health. What about customers? Any information about any customers getting sick?
Duncanson said they haven't seen any evidence at all that customers have gotten sick by eating there and being exposed to employees.
Another story that you reported on this week is about preschool and childcare. Parents certainly know that slots can be hard to find here on the Cape and Islands, and it can be expensive. What's happening on that?
There's a new effort across the state, actually, to push for more public funding for preschool and childcare. And this group, the Common Start Coalition, has a Cape and Islands chapter. So what they're hoping is really that all of this kind of newfound respect that people seem to have for how much work it is to actually stay home with a young child, which parents, of course, have been doing during the pandemic, they're hoping that will translate into some momentum for changes.
What kind of changes? What's the goal here?
Well, they want the state to kick in more public money, and there's going to be some tax origin to that. The idea is that the staff at these centers frequently are paid very little compared to public school teachers. They want them to get better wages, and they also want the price to come down for parents based on ability to pay. Hopefully, they say all of that will result in a better system with actually better education and care.
Have they talked about where the money is going to come from for all of that?
Sandy Feynman Silva of the Cape and Islands chapter told me it would be supported by some kind of package similar to the state's paid family and medical leave bill. So that could include taxes on employee wages and contributions from businesses and the state. But families would still pay some amount out of pocket on some kind of a sliding scale. And the group doesn't have a bill of legislation that they're supporting yet. She said they're working on a legislative agenda right now.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, Steve.
Contention over where to locate a charging station for electric buses has led committee members to resign from a group looking at that project. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times has this story and more. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, these committee members had voiced concerns about the planned location of this charging station. Tell us what they're looking at and what these concerns are about.
So this is located to be located on Church Street in Edgartown. It's where the visitor center is and a bus station. And the reason the VTA wants to put it there is all of their bus routes go through there. And this particular charging station, they want to go to all electric buses. So They need to have a place where these buses can get some more charge to them. I kind of look at it at like, you know, you buy something for your smartphone and you put it on your counter and you can put your phone on that and it charges it up. That's what happens with buses. They roll over this particular charging station, they get charged up and they move along on their route. But these two women are upset about it because one of them is talking about the historical character of that particular street in Edgartown. It is part of the historic district, and she thinks it will be a blight on that. That's Jane Chittick. And the other woman, Sarah Piazza, she lives on Upper Main Street, and she's concerned about the size of the buses, you know, making that corner, and thinks it'll be a problem with traffic and other issues that she has a concern with. So the two of them brought this to town meeting, got this advisory committee approved. The selectmen appointed the committee, including these two women, and they started to meet to talk about things. And Jane Chittick and Sarah Piazza weren't satisfied with where things were going. They in emails announcing their resignation, referred to it as a sham committee, saying that, you know, that they had no intention of looking at all of the issues that they thought needed to be addressed. And it got kind of nasty. These email exchanges were going on over the holiday weekend, the Labor Day weekend. And, you know, at one point, one of them referred to the chairman of the committee as an idiot. And that didn't go over well with other committee members who said, you know, they're just trying to do their job and do what's best for Edgartown. And, you know, that kind of language is uncalled for. So it was very, I'm sorry for the pun, but a very charged situation in Edgartown over the holiday weekend. And it spilled out into the week when the committee met for the first time after the resignations on Tuesday. Hasn't really gone away. I mean, I'm still being copied in email exchanges between these two former members and the committee members and Edgartown town officials. So hotly contested, to be sure.
Let me ask you about another story you've got in the paper this week. It's about the Oak Bluffs Fire Department, which was much in the news back in January and February with problems there. Now, selectmen have taken steps to reshape the department. They've created a new position. Tell us what's happened here.
I got to tell you, this took us by surprise, the reporter who was there and myself. This direction that the town's decided to take, they're appointing the police chief, Eric Blake, who's been in the position for quite a while, as a public safety director. So he'll be overseeing both departments. They do have an interim fire chief as well. And they hiring John Schilling. He's the retired Tisbury fire chief, just retired a couple of months ago from that job. Very well respected, both in Tisbury and island wide, for the job he did with the Tisbury Fire Department. They're bringing him on as a consultant, a civilian consultant, to help reshape the fire department and emergency medical department as well. The town leaders are looking to them to come back and say what direction needs to be taken. You know, whether they're looking at several different things, you know, whether the departments should remain together, should they be separated, and have individual chiefs over them. You know, and we could find out that this, you know, the town likes the way this works and they would have a public safety director over both the police and fire departments. That remains to be seen, but it is an interesting twist on all of this. And, you know, two respected individuals in the community and island-wide, you know, looking at, you know, what's been a problem department. So we'll look forward to seeing how this all shakes out.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good weekend.
You too. In Chatham, 62 trees were illegally cut down on a coastal bank. Now the property owners have been ordered to restore the land. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle has the story. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Steve.
Tim, this goes back to last year. Tell us about this property and what happened here and where this process is headed, it seems like.
Sure. As you said, it began last year, over a year ago, actually. In July 2019, the town's conservation agent was alerted by some neighbors to a report that trees had been cut down on a coastal bank. This is overlooking the Mill Creek in South Chatham, a property on Taylor's Pond Road. When Callie Harper, the agent, visited the site, she found the area had been cleared of, as you said, a total of 62 trees. And some of these weren't like, you know, scrub oaks. Some of these were large canopy trees with diameters of 24 inches or so. Mm. Many of them had been cut down to 1 foot or 2 feet off the ground. And all of this was done with no permits or review by the Conservation Commission or the Conservation Department. And as I said, it was on a coastal bank, which is a protected resource under both the Wetlands Protection Act, the state law, and the town's wetlands bylaw. Conservation officials said, you know, this is one of the most egregious violations they'd ever seen, and they contacted the property owner immediately. It was unclear whether this action was done, you know, at the direction of the property owner or if it was an overzealous landscaper, but officials spent the first few weeks after that trying to get a restoration plan developed by the owners, who were named Maria and Brian Donahue. They live in Pennsylvania. The first plan was rejected, and it took months to get a plan that the Conservation Commission approved of. Finally, last week, after a lot of back and forth, some executive sessions over possible litigation, the commission approved an enforcement order which requires that the area be restored. And basically, since most of these trees were cut to stumps, the commission is just requiring that the area be left to regenerate on its own with some supplemental plantings of some native trees and shrubs. But the commission members say that, you know, this is going to take a long time to happen, maybe 25 or 30 years to grow back to the way it was.
And even with this, the property owners seem to be still contentious in this set of discussions about what happens next.
Yeah, at the hearing last week where the commission approved this order, there was a lot of tense back and forth with the property owner and their attorney. You know, the commission, they didn't want the commission to approve an enforcement order, which it gets registered with the deed of the property, because they felt that that would devalue the property. The commission said, you know, this is the only way we have to ensure that this work gets done and that the area is left to grow back. The property owners didn't like some of the other conditions of the order involving fencing and other things. And they wanted more negotiations. The commission basically said, the chairman said, this is not a negotiation. We're issuing this order now. And the property owners said that they kind of threatened to take it to the next level, which would be filing a lawsuit appealing to DEP. The DEP, the state agency, has been involved in this. They wanted this to be resolved at the local level. So we're going to wait and see what steps are taken next. And one interesting thing is that the commission has the power to fine violations like this, but they haven't done that in this case. Mm. And there's a lot of people wondering why that hasn't happened, because it seemed like such a an egregious situation. My guess is that this is not over yet, and we'll be hearing more about it in the very near future.
Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks.
Thank you, Steve. Have a great weekend.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. The pandemic has led to a real estate boom. Many are wondering if it could have impacts for local school districts. Casey Myers of the Provincetown Independent has that story and joins us now. Hi, Casey.
Hello, how are you, Steve?
I'm doing well. Casey, let's start with the real estate side of this. You spoke to a number of local real estate agents. What did you hear?
Yes, it's quite an incredible bunch of stories. I'll try to encapsulate a couple of them. One, Kathleen Nagel sold a home in Wellfleet. She posted it. She showed it five times. The first day it got listed on the multiple listing service. And then 4 days later, when she cut off showings, she had 25 people had seen it, and she had 9 offers that were over the asking price. And that one sold almost $40,000 over the asking price for $566,090. Then Paul Grover told a story where there was a house on the market for $2.8 million in Barnstable. It was on the market on May 29th under agreement 2 days later and sold $100,000 over the market, over the asking price for $2.9 million. And then there's a third tale, and these weren't hard to find, by the way, of a guy who lives in Truro who sold his $2.25 million home. It was a 4,000 square foot property, and buyers from California looked at it on FaceTime and made an offer that afternoon after reviewing it on FaceTime. They've never seen it in person, and they paid cash.
They paid cash, of course.
So the
real estate market, but from these kinds of stories, it just seems to be, and what we've also heard from the real estate officials is that it's booming. This is a great moment, and this has to do with the pandemic, obviously. People looking for to get out of more congested areas, cities?
Yeah, get out of more congested areas, and they're realizing that so many people, that you can do so much more than you ever really thought from home. And that it might be nicer if your home is in Wellfleet than, say, in Boston or New York. Mm. So, yes, people are fleeing the city due to the coronavirus, and they're coming to the Cape. And so everyone kind of has been talking, well, that's going to be amazing for our Outer Cape schools, which have been losing students for years because of the same related issue of very wealthy people being able to move here. They don't, it's just a vacation home for them, and they're not going to send their kids here, but it drives up our real estate prices so that no year-round families can afford to live here. So you would think, hopefully, you would see something in the schools. And in two towns, Provincetown and in Wellfleet, that has happened. But none of the other Nauset communities that the Provincetown Independent covers, So Brewster all the way up to Wellfleet. Other than Wellfleet, it hasn't been a thing at all. And in Truro also, no real growth in the elementary school. And in the case of Wellfleet, which Mary Beth Rodman, the principal there, was specific with me, these were mostly second homeowners who were choosing to stay in the home they already own in Wellfleet and send their kids to school in Wellfleet, because the elementary school is offering in-person learning, which, as we know, of course, many communities are not around the country. So these families actually come from a lot of different towns in Massachusetts, but also New York and Washington, D.C.
So, and as you say, they're not buying here. These are second homeowners who are kind of relocating here so the kids can access in-person schooling.
Yes, exactly. In-person schooling is very, very hot. We think real estate is hot. I think many people are very interested, especially in the elementary school grades, of getting their children into a classroom so they can see their teacher in person. And it's just such a different situation in many different communities and states. So, yeah, so those two things are working in Wellfleet's favor. But it is curious to me why that isn't playing out across the board. Maybe it will later.
Yeah. Did any of the superintendents or folks at the schools you talked to sound like they were hopeful that's going to happen, or are they just kind of locked in for this year and trying to cope with this year?
Yes, I think everyone is trying to cope with this year. The Nauset district has been flip flopping and looking at their ventilation systems. I think Nauset High School just announced last night that they're going to offer a hybrid again. They've gone fully remote when they got there. Very bad grade on their ventilation report, and they think now they can offer in person again 2 days a week in October based on their latest work they've done. So yeah, it's just nonstop with the schools. I don't think they've had time to sit down and even look at their enrollment in some cases.
Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent. Casey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Nantucket saw 7 positive COVID cases in one day this week. It's a new high for the island. And the very next day, 7 more. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror is with us now. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, what can you tell us about this jump up in numbers?
I can tell you not a ton about the origin. Town officials have not released any information about where these cases have come from just yet, but I can certainly confirm that 14 cases have been reported in the last 2 days, on Wednesday and on Thursday, 7 cases each. The town health director, Roberto Santamaria, did say on Wednesday when the first 7 cases were confirmed that he believes it's probably related to some lax prevention behavior in the week leading up to Labor Day, end of the summer behavior, end of the summer parties, people, one last hurrah, as he called it, potentially. But no official information about whether this was a single event or multiple events or 14 separate cases at this point. We're still working on that. Again, the 14 positive tests in 2 days matches the total number of tests that were reported on Nantucket from March 17th to June 22nd. Nantucket had been doing very well up until the last couple of days, among the lowest, if not the lowest, number of cases of any county in the state, and one of the lowest positivity rates at under 1%. That did jump up to over 1% after yesterday's positive tests. And then just three cases had been reported on Nantucket in the week leading up to Wednesday, but again, 14 new tests brings the island's total to 77. On the positive side, if there is one, there are no hospitalizations on Nantucket or in the mainland for COVID-positive patients at this point.
I guess it just points up again, as if we needed one more reminder, how quickly this thing can turn back around if we're not paying attention.
It certainly can, and school officials actually also have decided to go all remote after planning to start with a hybrid model, given the first 7 cases on Wednesday, and certainly reaffirming that last night at a school committee meeting when the next 7 positives came in.
Let me ask you about another story you had this week. The offshore wind project Vineyard Wind has agreed to pay the town of Nantucket and local nonprofits $16 million to offset visual impacts. That's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money, $16 million over the next 8 to 10 years, up to $16 million. They're going to start by paying $4 million for its initial 250-square-mile project. That's about 15 miles southwest of the island's west end. And that money is going to be placed in a fund administered by the nonprofit Community Foundation for Nantucket and made available through grants to the town and island nonprofits for initiatives to combat climate change, promote alternative energy and coastal resiliency, and for restoration and preservation projects on Nantucket. Visual simulations have predicted that the project will be visible from much of the south shore and the west end of the island, and there have been some concerns raised about what that might do to Nantucket's status as a National Historic Landmark. The attorney representing the town, though, said he believes the project won't threaten that designation, and that the mitigation money they're talking about, the $4 million initially and then $3 million for each of 4 subsequent offshore projects that Vineyard Wind is doing, will go a long way toward mitigating any of those impacts as well.
And the sense is that this money is kind of based on how big the projects are and how much they move forward, though, right? Like you say, this $16 million, it's up to $16 million. It's not locked
up in. Up to $16 million. It's the $4 million is, for all intents and purposes, guaranteed, presuming that Vineyard Wind breaks ground, or breaks water, I guess, on its initial project. Which they expect to happen within the next year. And it certainly appears, though, that given the current climate federally and nationwide, that there might not be too many stumbling blocks to further offshore development of wind by both Vineyard Wind and a number of other companies. If all goes according to plan and according to the leases that have already been awarded, there's going to be a lot of turbines pretty much up and down the East Coast, perhaps, but certainly in the waters off of Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard.
That is Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tensions escalated in Somerset on Sunday night as Black Lives Matter protesters and supporters of President Trump claimed opposing sidewalks. Jack Spillane of the Standard Times in New Bedford is here to tell us about it. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Steve.
Jack, it sounds like this started as a Black Lives Matter protest that was planned for outside a pro-Trump business. Is that right?
Yes. the Black Lives Matter group, some of the people in New Bedford who were active, where we've had a lot of protests, decided that they would have what they were calling a lie-in in front of the Trump store, which is a store that sells Trump campaign items in Somerset. And they had planned to go up and lie in front of the store holding names of a series of victims of what they feel is police violence. And they had planned to do that. They had announced it ahead of time. In the meantime, the manager of the store organized a counter protest, and people from across New England came in. The owner of the store owns 9 other stores across New England, and they, I guess, commandeered the area in front of the store before the Black Lives Matter protesters got there, and so they never did do their lie-in. So it sort of descended into this protest competition on sidewalks. One side was protesting the police violence, and one side was defending President Trump. It was quite a few Trump supporters, more than the Black Lives Matter supporters were there, and getting very raucous with back and forth between the sides. I think the police wisely, as dusk descended, dispersed the group, as we've seen in other parts of the country, when these two opposing groups are emotions are running high after dark, sometimes some violence has happened. So the groups dispersed peacefully when the police ordered them to. But it was a little bit of what we've seen in other parts of the country, right here on South Coast.
Mm-hmm. And they had to call in police from a number of neighboring different departments. There must have been a sense that they really wanted that backup on the scene.
Yes, there was quite a bit of social media chatter before the event, and they were well prepared for it with backup. It was handled very well as far as we could see. And both sides followed the police's instructions. Although our reporter on scene, Tim Dunn, did say that at a certain point, the shouting and screaming and insulting back and forth was he was afraid that it might get out of control, but it did not.
Is there any word from these groups about follow-up demonstrations?
So we have had quite a few Black Lives Matter demonstrations all through the summer in New Bedford. They petered out as we got into August, but they continue to be active. They demonstrated at the State House in Boston this week on behalf of 8 victims of police violence, one of whom was a 15-year-old boy from New Bedford, Malcolm Gracier, who was killed 8 years ago. It was an interaction with police. A district attorney's investigation found the police were not to blame. However, many members of the Black community in New Bedford feel that the investigation did not get to all the facts.
Hmm. Jack Spillane of the Standard Times in New Bedford. Jack, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Steve.
This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. Cape Cod Healthcare announced this week it is stopping a planned $180 million expansion. Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times has the story for us. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. Good morning.
Cindy, this expansion was a big deal. They had a ceremonial groundbreaking for this, I remember, way back in the fall of last year, and they've been talking about this before that. This is a big project to suddenly come to a halt. Yeah, tell us about this.
Yeah, and another victim of the coronavirus, basically. It's $180 million. It was going to be a 6-story tower, and it will have a cancer center, additional cardiac and medical beds, and educational facilities, and importantly, also a certified trauma center. And that was going to reduce the need to send critically injured patients off Cape for treatment. So this is on hold now. On August 28th, the CEO and president of Cape Cod Healthcare, Michael Loft, announced that they were going to permanently lay off 118 workers who had been furloughed. And that included Paul Nedzwicki, who is the former longtime Cape Cod Commission executive director. And he was hired to, he was given a 3-year contract to oversee this project.
So with the pandemic, just the financials of this came to a halt because Cape Cod Healthcare has taken such a hit.
It's they said it's $111 million hit, and they did receive aid from the government, about $45 million, but it hasn't, come close to making up the shortfall. Basically, they had a halt of elective surgeries, hundreds of elective surgeries, and in addition to, and then people that weren't seeing the doctors that were part of the Cape Cod healthcare system, and things kind of ground to a halt except for the most essential surgeries. But in the meantime, they also had to kind of step up to the plate, and they operated 3 step-down facilities, including that hospital that was a Joint Base Cape Cod. That was in case that the hospitals were overflowing. There was a fear and concern on the state's part that these hospitals would be overflowing in their ICUs, and they would need step-down facilities to handle patients as they were, recovering from coronavirus. Thank goodness that didn't happen, but they did step up to the plate and open facilities, as well as the mobile testing unit at Cape Cod Community College that saw thousands of people come by for testing. And in addition to that, ordering all the PPEs and all the extra things that the staff needed to deal with to reduce the threat of infection and contagion.
So do they have a sense of, is this off the table? Is this just off to the side for a while? It sounds like Paul Nedzwicki, who was in charge of this, he's gone from the project now, so it's not something they can restart very real quickly when they pick it up again.
Well, the spokesman for Cape Cod Healthcare, Patrick Haynes, said the tower is not permanently on hold. He said, we will do something, but it will be scaled back. And he said, we can't begin to re-energize those discussions until COVID is in the past. So this is something that they plan to continue with. They haven't indicated exactly when that would happen or how big the project would be. This is sort of, an expansion of the campus. It's across the campus a bit from the Mugard Tower, but would be another, tall structure, right there on the waterfront. And this is something that, it's the future of it is uncertain right now, but the Cape Cod healthcare officials said they do plan to do something sometime, and it will be scaled back.
Even before they got all the way to this point, they had advanced these plans and this great vision for it, and then kind of stepped back to try to get some more community input on how this was actually going to impact the area already. There was kind of back and forth about how this was supposed to proceed before we even hit COVID.
Right. They pulled back the reins a bit this winter, just before COVID really hit. Through its attorney, it withdrew what's called the Development of Regional Impact application with the Cape Cod Commission in late January. It also withdrew a site plan review application with the town of Barnstable. And they said, Cape Cod healthcare officials said they wanted to provide more opportunity for community involvement before they continued with a regulatory approval process. And there are a lot of issues, for instance, traffic. I mean, it's a little bottleneck already, of traffic in that area of Hyannis, with shift changes and everything, and the busyness of the summer, which is located near the ferries. So transportation was one issue that local officials and residents definitely wanted to weigh in on.
It's Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times with the story. Cindy, thank you.
Okay, have a great day.
The question of a gaming hall for Aquinnah is headed back to court. Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette is on the line with us with this story. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, it seems like the story has been in suspension for a while, but it is now moving forward. This is about a proposed bingo hall. The town and the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead Aquinnah going to court over how this could or should move forward. Explain what's happening here now.
So the town and tribe, they're set to meet in the U.S. Court of Appeals on Monday. You're right, it has been in suspension for a while. This is nearly a year after the last court meeting. That came before the U.S. District Court back last summer. And the District Court, the question that's at play here right now is whether the tribe needs to obtain state and local building permits before beginning construction on the facility. And the U.S. District Court ruled that they did, sort of surprisingly. And the tribe appealed, but that was all last year. And now a year later, they're finally meeting in the U.S. Court of Appeals again.
And the surprise here is in part because the tribe is presuming it has sovereignty and it can pretty much do what it wants on its land, right?
Right. Yeah. The legal crux of the issue is around this question of the Indian. It's really around the scope of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, which is also known as IGRA. The tribe believes that the act sort of preempts any sort of state and local restrictions on building and that kind of thing. The town is arguing the opposite, that it doesn't. But really, you know, I think sort of the bigger thing here is that the town and tribe, I mean, they're no strangers to courtrooms. 3 years ago, the two sides went to federal court over the question of whether they could even build the facility at all. The district court determined that they couldn't, and then the appeals court reversed that decision, and the Supreme Court upheld that. But when it was remanded back to the district court, a final judgment was never issued. So that's kind of what's allowed this window for the building permit question to be opened. And that's what happened last year when the tribe started construction on the facility.
Well, it's interesting that you say that there are no strangers to going to court over this, because in your article you point out that a lot of the same players are back here, you know, 4 or 5 years later with the same taking this case forward again with a different angle
right
now, obviously. But some of the same attorneys and even the same judges hearing the case.
Right. It's sort of amazing that the question of building permits is still the thing that's getting litigated right now. You're right. The two of the judges on the U.S. Court of Appeals this go round were on the three judge panel last time. That panel, of course, sided with the tribe last time. The district court judge that heard the question of building permits initially was the same judge that had sided with the town initially. Almost all the attorneys are the same. The town's retained an attorney from the firm Goodwin. But other than that, it's pretty much the same players that are going on. And the site out in Aquinnah looks virtually the same as it did a year ago. It's this interesting thing that construction started and then everything went to court and then it was paused. And the tribe is arguing that they, you know, they're basically refusing to get any state and local building permits because they feel that they're, one, unduly burdensome, and two, that the tribe's own sort of jurisdictional regulatory ability, they can cover that. They're basically asserting sovereignty, which is, it's a really interesting question. And sort of, I think that the angle or tack the tribe is taking legally is that if the district court's decision that they do need to get local building permits is upheld, it could have really lasting and sort of sweeping implications for tribes across the country. That would be a problem for economic development, at least tribal economic development. One of their other arguments is that the town, it has been unfair in how they issue building permits and whatnot, which is something the town, of course, is contending is untrue.
And real briefly, just for folks who don't have all the backstory here, because we've been talking about this for a long time, they're talking about building a bingo kind of hall, or it's not like a full-on casino. It's something sort of scaled back, but initially the whole thing is kind of planned to be under a very temporary structure.
Yes, exactly. So when the tribe cleared a bunch of land out in Aquinnah, they released a press statement that said that it was going to be a 10,000 square foot thing called a sprung structure, which if you look up, it's sort of, you know, it's sort of a tent-like structure. It's sort of a more permanent tent-like structure. It was going to have 250 electronic games. The facility, I think basically the permit that they got is a class 2 gaming facility, which means that, you know, bingo, basically, and other sort of very specific types of games. You're right. It's not a full-scale casino like the ones that are planned in Taunton or other places, you know, around southeastern Massachusetts. It's a totally different thing, but still it's out in Aquinnah, which is one of, if not the least developed towns in the Commonwealth, which is sort of, I think, at the essence of the issue here.
Noah Asmo of the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
Now that the dust has settled on last week's primary elections, we have a better idea of what Beacon Hill is going to look like when the new legislature comes into session in January. Earlier, I talked with CAI reporter Mike Dean about that story and more news from the State House. Here's our conversation. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Mike, as you talked about last week, nearly all of Beacon Hill's incumbent lawmakers were reelected last week in their party primaries. Will many of these incumbents be facing challenges in the general election?
Not as many as you would think. In Massachusetts, we have one of the least competitive legislatures in the entire country. Very few people just decide to run, you know, for the Senate or the House. So that leaves a kind of low rate of challenges and a high rate of returning incumbents every year. So this year, only 21% of those House seats are going to be contested in November, and only 15% of the Senate seats are going to be up in November. That means that, you know, the bulk of these real challenges came in the primaries that we saw last week, and so November kind of becomes clear sailing for much of the legislature, but it lets us kind of work out who is going to be returning to Beacon Hill in January and what that could mean for the agenda.
Hey, what about the police reform bill? We talked a lot about it when it was first proposed, and then it lost steam after lawmakers voted to extend their session. Can we expect lawmakers to pick that up now that the primary is over, or will things remain quiet because now we're heading toward the general election in November?
Yeah, the primary election really was the first hurdle. Not a lot of folks running in those races wanted to deal with another hard vote on police reform while, you know, battling out fellow Democrats in their primaries. And also, August is a month where it's, you know, it's vacation month for practically everyone. Not a lot of hard, solid work gets done during those months, at least not the kind of compromises and negotiations that need to take place, especially for this police bill. And of course, that's still currently between the House and the Senate. There's a small committee that's kind of reconciling the two versions of the bill. But of course, this is an ongoing debate that's much wider than just this one committee. You know, police unions and other advocacy groups, Black Lives Matter supporters, and civil rights groups are, of course, lobbying both, you know, the sides of this debate to try to get what they want in that final bill. And that's caused something of a stalemate. You know, because it's such a hot topic, it would be likely that the compromise is now going to come at the earliest after the November general election. And that's because there's kind of doubt that any bill that they come up with is going to satisfy, you know, conservative and moderates on one side that want to keep in protections for police and to satisfy progressives who want to go further and kind of remove those protections that police have and add more accountability to policing. So we're kind of stuck for now as things go on.
And finally, Mike, briefly, Governor Baker had some stern words for the federal government when it comes to unemployment benefits this week. Tell us about this.
Yeah, Baker has been pretty consistent when kind of criticizing the federal government's response to this pandemic, especially when it comes to funding for the state and municipalities and for unemployment benefits. So right now, there are some emergency funds from FEMA that are going to provide an additional $300 a week for unemployed folks here in Massachusetts. That's money left over from the CARES Act from before. But Baker's really been criticizing both Democrats and Republicans at the federal level for not extending that $600 benefit they had, making that the nationwide program extended. And he's been really critical in saying that any kind of new stimulus bill needs to include money for states and local governments, because he says those are the governments that are spending the most and really having the biggest impact on people's lives as they get through this pandemic. Now, the last Republican proposal in the U.S. Senate didn't include any additional funds for states and locals, and so Baker is hoping that at some point they get something across, because the financial situation in Massachusetts without a federal bailout is going to be dire. I think we're going to see some budget proposals popping up over the next few months that could very well include massive cuts to spending in the state, potentially layoffs to some programs, and it's going to be a very hard budget unless the feds help out.
Mm. That's CAI State House reporter Mike Dean. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
The Cape Cod Commission is releasing a breakdown of the region's greenhouse gas emissions with the goal to strategically limit regional drivers of climate change. CAI's environmental and climate change reporter Eve Zuckoff has taken stock of the commission's inventory and joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, what actually is the breakdown of the sectors that produce the most greenhouse gases in this region?
Yeah, so heating and electricity in homes and businesses, that's about 39%. It's a pretty good chunk. And then the more interesting one, actually, that I want to talk about is the transportation sector. That produced 55% of our regional greenhouse gas emissions. And that's compared to the state average, which is about 43%. So we're emitting a lot more through transportation. And the way that was explained to me is that we just don't really have as much agriculture and industrial production here. We import a lot, and we have also, you know, just a greater dependence on the single person automobile than the rest of our state. But when you look at the whole pie, it's pretty incredible that more than half of it is transportation.
So what does that mean for the commission and for how we can try to target these sectors, and including transportation?
Yeah, so we really can actually do something about this. And the way that you can target transportation is you can have people either travel less or travel by more efficient means. And that's probably going to be easier, right? So we can, the commission is looking at electrifying buses, getting that like fleet electrification to really influence every bus on Cape Cod. And also at the same time, the commission is working right now on a study to figure out where charging stations should be so that really to encourage people to buy their own electric vehicles. And they at the same time want to promote more walking, more biking, more public transit. And as we've seen, you know, through COVID-19, a lot of people who work office jobs have been able to telecommute. They've been able to not commute. And also when we get at they target these sectors, they actually have to. By 2050, the state has set a mandate to reach net zero. That means that for all the emissions that we put out into the atmosphere through production, through, you know, transportation that isn't converted to electric vehicles, we have to pull those emissions out of the atmosphere so that it's balanced, so that we end up with net zero emissions. And we have 30 years to get there. Transportation has to be part of that.
Well, this week you did report on how climate change is already affecting the region. You found that this was the hottest summer ever recorded in Massachusetts. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so according to this report from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the average temperature for the continental U.S. this summer was 73.6 degrees Fahrenheit. That's 2.2 degrees above average. And so in Rhode Island, Connecticut, Arizona, Massachusetts, they all endured their warmest summers on record. The record goes back 126 years, the 1800s. And at the same time, precipitation was low. This year was in the driest third of the historical record. And yeah, as you say, this is climate change. Climate change is increasing the frequency and severity of extreme heat events, which can exacerbate drought and increase the likelihood of wildfires, as we've been seeing in the western half of this country. And here, too, the entire state of Massachusetts is currently experiencing a significant drought. That's how the state classifies it. So we're really affected by this. This is very real for us.
That's CAI's environmental and climate change reporter, Eve Zukoff. Eve, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford. We spoke with Cindy McCormick at the Cape Cod Times, Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette, Mike Dean up at the State House, and there, CAI's Eve Zukoff. Big thanks to Dan Treidel back at the studio, maestro of the control room, working the phones and the transitions and cueing the music too. And thanks to my family. First day back to remote school for my daughter, so we're sharing the internet access right now. Thank you, Ursula. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.